Once more under the breach, dear friend. Else fill up the wall with our English dead. And here we are, ladies and gentlemen, boys and girls, with another exciting second hour of The Personal Wealth Coach, starring Jeff McClure. Jake is out of town. And we do need to announce once more that The Personal Wealth Coach is not only the name of this radio program, it's also the name of an SEC registered investment advisor based in Salado, Texas, that does wealth family management, what's called family office or family wealth management, and wealth management for higher net worth people. And the information that we present on here is not investment advice. It is instead intended to be educational, and you really should not go out and buy or sell based on what we say on this program. Because it's generally a bad idea. You need to look at this. It needs to be looked at very specifically, and very specifically in your situation. And we discourage taking any direct investment action based on anything we see on the program, although we do check out our data, and what we're saying is from sources that we believe to be reliable. We talked about the fact that the stock market this week, the S&P 500, closed down 3.58% at 26,32.56, and that means it's about 10% down from its peak that it hit in late September. That's the second time it's been 10% down. It's called a confirming correction. And for whatever it's worth, it is our analysis at the Personal Wealth Coach that this is just exactly that. It's a correction. This is where the stock market realizes it's overreached. Collectively, the investors in the stock market realize they've overreached. They've overpriced some stocks, very specifically the high growth stocks, generally the FANG stocks, the tech stocks, the Facebook, the Amazon. You look at these stocks and you realize that some of them are still good, solid purchases, and some of them are not so good, but their prices were based primarily on anticipated earnings in the future, and those anticipated earnings in the future were based on what they've done over the past few years. But in the past few years, they've been filling a gap that is getting harder and harder to fill because it's getting filled up, and they're running out of new people to hire. And when they, in order to hire people, they have to raise wages, and when they raise wages, that is going to eat into their profitability. There's other things eating in their profitability. A lot of the growth that's occurred in the last 9 years in the stock market and in the economy has been because of borrowed money. A lot of companies have borrowed money that didn't even need to borrow money because interest rates were just that low. Interest rates were effectively zero for a high-quality borrower for a long time. And now they're starting to come up and beginning to impact, and it's starting to cost money to borrow money, so they're going to slow things down a little bit. They're not borrowing as much money. They're not going to grow as fast. There's a second issue there. The money that they're pumping into new things is less productive than it was before because of infrastructure constraints. We have a caller on 254-773-1400. So, caller, you're on the air with the Personal Wealth Coach. Go ahead.
Yes, sir. I was just wanting to ask you concerning money. Like, you know, when you see money from back in the day, like Buffalo nickels, Susan B. Anthony dollars, $2 bills, you know, you would see them in circulation quite a bit, but then as time goes on, you don't really see that money anymore. But it still exists, but you just don't see it. Can you explain to me what the reason is being? And you remember that 50-cent piece that had a Kennedy picture
sure.
on it?
Right.
You don't see that no more yeah. around. You have a good day, sir.
Well, basically, it's not because the government pulls them out of circulation. When you see money disappear, like the $2 bill, it's because it never was popular. The Susan B. Anthony dollar, if you have the ability to carry around a piece of paper that weighs next to nothing and a coin, you probably would tend to go for the piece of paper. Now, the coin would be better for the mint because it lasts longer, but the problem is a Susan B. Anthony dollar is very much the size of a quarter, and people would inadvertently spend a Susan B. Anthony dollar thinking they were spending a quarter, which is rather disheartening. Why does the John F. Kennedy dollar go out of popularity? Because it's too big. It is, if you look at the size of that dollar coin, the old dollar coin, and you look at the size of a dollar, the size and weight of a dollar bill, it's sure a lot easier to carry dollar bills around than it is those coins. It's just a matter of simplicity. And it's a matter of practicality, and it's a matter that the Treasury does a terrible job, generally speaking, of doing the research, and in many cases they're forced to produce a kind of money because somebody in Congress thought it was a good idea who also did a terrible job of doing research. There is a very good argument, by the way, for getting rid of pennies. I think personally we would do very well to get rid of pennies, except for the fact it would be tremendously unpopular. It costs the government more than a cent to make a cent at this point. And they're a pain in the you-know-what to carry around in your pocket. But the merchants don't want to get rid of them. And people don't want to pay a nickel when they could pay a penny. And so we're probably going to be stuck with it for some time to come. Eventually, I think the penny has got to go away. Money is kind of a funny thing. And one of the oddities when you talk about the money that's not in circulation anymore, the percentage of actual transactions going on using cash in the United States declines each year. The use of cash is declining. And in I was just talking to some people who'd recently been to China, and they told us that the use of cash in China was almost non-existent at this point. Everything was done by apps, basically the equivalent of the app on your Apple phone or something. People actually do transactions via messaging from cell phone to cell phone, and that's the way almost all the transactions are done because they don't trust the currency and they don't trust the banks, and there's a lack of trust in the system. In the United States, we have a tremendous amount of trust in our currency. Interestingly enough, so does the rest of the world, which is one of the reasons that this year, year-to-date, the United States dollar has increased in value somewhere between 5 and 6%. Against a basket of currencies monitored by the Wall Street Journal. It's called the WSJ Dollar Index. And it continues to rise against the rest of the world. As a matter of fact, it's up 7% against the Chinese yuan and renminbi, which is the currency in China. We have 10% tariffs on a lot of things that come out of China, but if you do the math on that, the tariffs are almost completely eliminated by the rise in the dollar. Why did the dollar go up? Well, the dollar goes up because we have a booming economy and interest rates are going up, so people need to buy dollars in order to invest in U.S. Treasury securities, which pay a higher interest rate than any other stable governmental-backed securities in the world. The German equivalent of Treasury securities, in the shorter durations, are still negative numbered. In other words, if you buy them, you will get less money. If you buy them today, let's say you bought a 2-year or a 5-year note of a Bund in Germany, federal backed loan, you'll actually get less return to you in 2 or 5 years when it matures than you paid for it. And in the United States, the reverse is true. You get everything you paid for, plus you get interest on it along the way, and the interest is now getting high enough that it makes it more and more attractive, which tends to run the dollar up. Another factor, again, are the tariffs. The tariffs have at least partially been credited with a slight slowing in the growth rate of the economy in China. And when the growth rate in the economy in China starts to fall off a little bit, their currency tends to decline against the dollar, or the dollar rises against that currency. Either one is a true statement. One of the ironies is that the end result, this is one of those strange economic ironies, the tax cuts overstimulated the United States economy to the point where, of course, we had over 4% GDP growth in the second quarter after the tax cuts began to have an effect. And the consensus of economists now is that 2.5% annualized growth in the fourth quarter is what we're looking at. Moody's is saying 2.6%, so 2.6% GDP growth, which is still above trend. And according to the consensus of all the major economists and schools, still not sustainable. In other words, about a 1.8%, 1.6 to 1.8% annual GDP growth is about as much as the United States can sustain. If we run faster than that, we overload our infrastructure, and we will fall back below it at some point in the future, which is one of the reasons economists are pretty much in agreement at this point that there's about an 85 to 90% chance that we'll have a recession in 2020. Why? Because we have outrun our infrastructure. And the momentum of building new things and creating new things and new manufacturing and so on will hit the wall at that point, and suddenly there will be people start to get laid off, which will lower demand further, and that will cause wages to fall again. And it's a typical economic cycle, and it's theoretically, at least that's what the economists are saying. I tend to agree with them that the tax cuts and spending increases by the government exacerbated that. Now, where do we have any evidence that that is actually going on? Yeah, we actually do. Last month in October, durable goods orders by factories, in other words, manufacturing companies ordering durable goods. Durable goods are things that are expected to last more than 3 years while they use them, dropped by 4.4% in the month of October. That's not annualized. It's just a 4.4% drop. Earlier in the year, we saw 11% gains in a given month as they bought a lot of stuff. And the factories are basically saying, we've bought all the long-term goods we're going to buy with the tax cut money because we just can't use anymore. We're hitting constraints on what we can make. The production long-term goods, in other words, the machinery and equipment that's necessary to actually produce things in the manufacturing chain, leveled off to effectively neutral for the month of October, which means that there was no acceleration, there was no deceleration. It didn't fall, but it went from a pretty big acceleration earlier in the year as the tax cut money and the depreciation the acceleration in depreciation that people were allowed to write off the whole value, the thing that they bought for production in the same year they buy it this year, basically has run its course. And once again, we run up against the infrastructure constraint that says if I buy the factory, the company that owns the factory is saying, if I buy more stuff to make stuff with, I can't get it to market because we're out of truck drivers, we're out of trucks, the highways are jammed, the railroads are running at full capacity. There's no way to get my products to somebody who can buy them if I make more of them, so I'm hitting a limit on what I can do here. Now, why can't it just stay that way? That's one of the big issues. Why can't we just get up to this full employment? But that's everybody's dream, by the way, every economist's dream, and certainly every politician's dream, that you get up to full employment, you get up to full productivity, you get up, the factories are fully productive and the highways stay jammed, and there's just continuous good times. I don't remember the guy from The Economist from Yale who in 1929 said just in early October of 1929, just before the crash, he said, we've reached a permanent plateau of prosperity. And there has been some major announcement. It made all the headlines and all the papers across the country. And it has inevitably, by the way, just before a major crash, you have somebody who says something like that, and it makes headlines across the country, and everybody gets really excited, and they go out and make their final buying run, and then it falls apart. So why doesn't that work? Well, what we've seen is this year, the consumer, who constitutes about 70% of our economy, is us making stuff or importing stuff to sell to regular people like you and me. The consumer is leveling off. In other words, they had a surge in new buying that occurred after the tax cuts hit, and the consumer was when we look at the savings rate, it dropped off, which meant people are actually towards as recently as September, were actually spending, on average, the consumer in the United States was spending more money than they were making. In other words, their savings rate went negative, and they started running their credit cards up. And now they've slacked off again because, among other things, interest rates are starting up and they're beginning to feel the pain from the credit cards. So when I say slacked off, they've come back to the point where they're only spending increases in their pay. Now, admittedly, their pay is going up on an average of 3.5% a year, but the tax cut extra money is spent. So when it comes to growth, they're not going to spend a bunch of more money next year than they spent this year because the tax cut stimulus is over with. And so they are at the point where we don't see an acceleration from them. So why wouldn't we have a recession? The next question, that if you're an economic geek, is if we've peaked out at this point due to the stimulus, why wouldn't the slowdown start next year in 2019? Why are we saying 2020? Well, there's a great lag in one aspect of the stimulus that hit the economy this year, and that is government spending. We increased government spending by about $300 billion a year, and that money hasn't been spent yet. It takes a while for the government to create their budgets and figure out how they're going to spend it. It's mostly defense spending, and it's going to hit the economy in 2019, which will provide a second wave of stimulus at some level in the economy. But if you watch the numbers very carefully, the core manufacturing index probably will start to decline next year while the overall manufacturing index continue to hold their own or even rise. The core filters out defense spending and aircraft spending from what's going on in the manufacturing economy in the United States, and it brings it back to the stuff that's not artificially stimulated by the government's decisions. And you'll see it probably start to fall next year, and we're already starting to see evidence that it's going to fall next year. And if that happens, then you can say that 2019 will be the peak. Sometime late 2019 or going into 2020, you will see things start to turn downhill. Why? Well, because manufacturers and the rest of the system tends to keep on building stuff. They can't say, okay, I'm going to build, for instance, for Christmas, they can't say, we're going to manufacture a toy on December 24th and sell it on 23rd and sell it on the 24th. They have to ramp up months in advance in anticipation of the purchases that are going to come for Christmas. And there's a big lag there, so they have to plan well in advance. And there's this tendency to say, when times are good and people are buying an awful lot of whatever we're making, let's make some more of it and sell some more of it. And to the degree they do that, they over-manufacture at some point. So you see what are called rises in inventories, where there's a bunch of unsold stuff sitting around, which means that once you start seeing increases in inventories in the system, across the system, then the orders to factories start slowing down and the factories start laying people off. Well, when the people start getting laid off the factory, they can't buy the toy anymore. Therefore, the purchasing rate begins to slow. And meanwhile, you've got this overhang of inventory that people are trying to sell. And the purchase rate is slowing. And as it slows even further, they lay off more people. And that's how we get into the negative side of the economic cycle. And economists, we're going to see if this works real well. There's a great experiment going on. The economists of the world are on one side of the experiment, and they're saying this is the cycle, this is how it's going to work. The tax cuts and the increased spending by the government is going to exacerbate a bad situation, and we're going to get a big recession around 2020. The Trump administration and the advisors to the Trump administration, I would say probably Larry Kudlow and others, somebody is strongly suggesting that we can keep stimulating the economy and avoid the next recession. So this is what I referred to in the newsletter as the great experiment. This is a great economic experiment to say, is economic theory correct? Because if economic theory is correct, then the tax cut and the stimulus that we're getting and continuing to get is a bad idea. If the Trump administration and the people who are advising the Trump administration, including some economists, are correct and the egghead economists are wrong, then we won't have a recession in around 2020. Everything will continue to run just fine. We won't have inflation, and everything will run along just fine. It's a great experiment. It's a great test from a purely academic point of view to see if the economic theories about why these things happen actually work, or if they're just a bunch of eggheads who've come up with a bunch of long words and big mathematical formulae that don't work, and common sense, gut reaction, populist view of what ought to work works. So we'll see going forward. It's an interesting experiment. It's going to be a little scary, probably, one way or the other, but it's certainly fascinating to see it work out, and I'm basically sort of looking forward to seeing it work out. I'm in a position where I can sit back and watch it happen, which is kind of convenient. If you're on the margin and you're just barely making it, it's probably not going to be anywhere near as entertaining, but it would be probably more exciting for you. You are listening to the Personal Wealth Coach. The telephone number in here is 254-773-1400. Today, if today is the 24th of November, where you are is just like it is where we are. Talking about the markets, you know, we talked about the fact that the stock market was down for the week and is now down a little over 10%, 10.4% from where it was in late September, which makes this officially a correction. It's the second correction, second time we've gone below 10%. I don't think it's going to evolve into anything bigger than this, maybe a little. I suspect coming out of it, we're going to see some recovery. But there's another market out there that we don't pay as much attention to. That's the bond market. And the best indicator we found is the Barclays U.S. Aggregate Bond Index. It basically it's an index of all the bonds bought and sold in the United States, put together by Barclays. It used to be Lehman Brothers. Lehman Brothers doesn't exist anymore, so Barclays brought the index. It's now down 4.92% for 1 year, which means that if you bought bonds at the beginning of the year thinking we're going to get a downturn this year, on average, if you bought bonds and you got out of stocks and got into bonds, instead of being basically at zero for the year where you are with stocks, you'd be down about 5% at this point. And it's averaged down about 0.95% for the last 3 years. Why is that happening? Well, it's happening because interest rates are rising. And it's an important thing to understand about bonds. The average bond in the United States right now in the Barclays Index is trading at 104.67, which you say, what's that mean? That means it's trading at 4.6, the actual price of the bond before you pay transaction costs is 4.67% above its maturity value, which means if you hold that bond to maturity and you bought it in the open market, you have a virtually guaranteed loss of 5%, not counting inflation. So if you bought a 10-year bond and we have 2% inflation, which is very conservative between now and then, you'd have about a 10% or better loss in purchasing power when you 5 years out from now in that bond. So you would stand, if you purchased the bond and you spent the interest on the bond, when you receive back, would be worth 10% less than what you paid for it, roughly. That's a very rough estimate. And you could say, yeah, but I got interest along the way. Yeah, but if you add up all the interest you got during that time period and take inflation and taxes out of that, you still didn't do very well. You did very poorly. So bond prices, the bond market is still somewhat, not radically, but somewhat overpriced. The stock market is slightly underpriced, which gives long-term strategic investors a bit of a pause. If you're doing indexes, if you're doing index funds and you're doing index investing, you're kind of stuck right now because it's, as one article that I read in Financial Times put it, it's too late to buy into stocks to get the big rally coming off of 2009, and it's too soon to buy into bonds to catch the fall in interest rates and the appreciation in the value of bonds. So you're kind of stuck. And this is the point in the cycle where stock picking begins to be valuable, where professional management of investments and asset classes, generally speaking, historically at this point, begin to outperform indices. Why? Because the indexes have pretty well stabilized at neutral. And from here forward, it's hard to see a big gain in an inefficiency in an index or an asset class. So what has to happen is, somebody has to look around and say, ah, there's this company over here that is got a lot of cash, it's profitable, everything is looking good in the company, but because it's unpopular, it's been beat down for no particular reason. And so people go to looking at balance sheets, and they start looking at the underlying value of the company with the idea that they will eventually be able to profit if they buy the company now when it's low. And speaking of profitability and things of that nature, KTEM is in the habit of playing commercials so that Town Square Media can make money. And we're going to allow that to happen. You are listening to the Personal Wealth Coach. My name is Jeff McClure. The telephone number in here is 254-773-1400. If today is November 24th, you're certainly welcome to give us a call. And we'll be back on the other side after these important words from Town Square Media sponsors. And we're back with more of the Personal Wealth Coach with Jeff McClure. Jake's out of town this week, and so Jeff is here by his lonely. Telephone number in here, 254-773-1400. We got a little more to talk about. And about 26 minutes left in the second hour of the Personal Wealth Coach. You're welcome to give us a call in here at 254-773-1400 if today is November 24th where you are, like it is where we are. You know, we talked about the economic cycle that's created by a business lag, and it's called by a production lag. And you can see that lag coming when businesses stop investing in new equipment to make more stuff because they've hit their limits, and that type of thing tends to happen, and it's going on right now. But let me give you an example of how that lag worked. In September of this year, actually in October of this year, oil hit record levels recent for the price of oil. It was up in the $80 range and was roaring along very nicely. Looked like it was just going to go like gangbusters. And now it's down to 50, and that means it's in a bear market. It's down. West Texas Intermediate Oil is in about a 30% decline from its peak. And what happened? Well, oil production in Saudi Arabia and Russia ramped up in anticipation of because oil prices were high. And with oil prices high, they could make more money, and they needed more money. Russia is hurting for money for many reasons, not the least of which is sanctions. Saudi Arabia is trying to transition their economy, and they're having some difficulties, so they also want more money. So they ramped their oil production up. But also because, very frankly, the Saudis ramped their oil production up, and the Russians did too, because the president of the United States asked them to. Why did he ask them to? Because he was going to put sanctions against Iran, which could cause an oil shortage, which could cause the price of oil to go up, and the economy to slow down. All makes perfectly good sense, except in this particular case, there were several major countries that were issued exemptions from the oil sanctions against Iran. And they're continuing to take oil from Iran, and so we never encountered the shortage. The other side of that kept the shortage from occurring is that about that same point where oil was hitting that relatively high number, the United States became the largest oil producer in the world. We have passed Russia and Saudi Arabia now, and we're still cranking along. The issue is that when you drill a well, and you've got money invested in the well, and you've got money invested in everything, all the infrastructure around it, and the tankers and everything else that you need to have to make it work, you can't just say, well, there's too much oil being produced, we'll just shut this down, because you borrowed the money to drill the well. You borrowed the money to buy the tankers. You borrowed the money to have all the infrastructure that takes to get that oil to market. And you got to pump oil and sell oil in order to make that work, and we've surged in our oil production again, and we are continuing to produce more oil. What's more, we basically hit a problem with oil in the United States in that the backlog of oil in oil tanks at places like Cushing, Oklahoma, has been rising rather quickly. They're building new oil tanks as fast as they can to put the oil in, but we're producing more oil than we can get out of the country there or that we can process. And the reason is pipelines. We don't have it's infrastructure that's putting a restraint on here. But a lot of money, a lot of private money has been invested in expanding our pipeline capacity in the United States, mainly along existing pipeline routes where they don't have to get special clearance. And that those new pipelines are going to start to come online in 2019. And when that happens, a lot of the backlog in oil that's in tanks is going to flow out, and we're going to see, I would not be at all surprised to see in 2019, a really impressive drop in the price of oil, which is going to make the oil producers around the country cry in their beer and be unhappy. But that's the boom and bust cycle of oil. And, of course, once that happens, they'll start shutting down wells and they'll stop drilling wells. And sometime in 2020 or 2021, we'll hit a low point in oil production. And at that point, something else will occur. Who knows what else? But the price of oil will start back up again. And, of course, as it starts back up again, you can't just instantly put a hole in the well or open up a new well. You have to gradually bring these things back up to speed. So there's this basic lag between supply and demand that's cyclical. And it occurs across the entire economy of the world, and it occurs across the United States economy, and that is what drives the short-term economic cycle train. And it's really important to understand that if you're going to be an investor, not so you can time the market. Timing the market doesn't work. The reason I say it doesn't work, it looks like you ought to be able to time it, but throughout the history of attempted market timing, nothing has ever worked consistently. As soon as a market timer looks like they've got it down pat, something will happen, and they'll wind up selling out of the market at what they think is a down market. The market will suddenly shoot back up, and they have to buy back in at a more expensive price and lose a tremendous amount of money, and they get thrown off, and pretty quick they've lost it, and they've had to shut down the hedge fund. There have been literally thousands of hedge funds shut down in the last couple of years because they missed the market cycles. They were trying to time the market. They were trying to do all these fancy things that they thought were sure enough going to work, and the really smart people who were running them were taking big risks and lost a lot of money, and they shut them down. And in many cases, the investors get back a lot less than they put into those things. Hedge funds in general have done very poorly over the last several years. They got a big reputation for a while, and then their reputation kind of fell on its face. And that's just the way the real world works, which takes me to another area. By the way, you are listening to the Personal Wealth Coach, and telephone number in here is 254-773-1400. Bitcoin. For those of you who have really long-term memories that go back to 2017, you remember that Bitcoin rose to nearly $20,000 per Bitcoin. I don't know the exact price at this moment. It's kind of hard to tell precisely what the price is, but it's around $4,300 now. That is a heck of a loss. To come from nearly $20,000 to between $4,000 and $5,000, even to come down to $5,000 is a 75% loss. It's actually lost about 80%. And there's the only reason it hasn't lost more is there's a lot of people are hanging on, waiting for it to come back. And we said at the time this was going to happen. Why did we say it was going to happen? Were we prescient? Were we prophets or something? No. The Bitcoin has a certain advantage in that it's anonymous. It is not dependent upon any government, but is a crucial element in Bitcoin or any similar type idea, or gold for that matter. But primarily the Bitcoin has little value to no value because it has no value. Now think about that just a minute. What is it that backs the Bitcoin? Nothing. What is it that when you buy a Bitcoin, what is it that you're guaranteed you can purchase with it once you buy it? Dollars. Now, you may wind up with fewer dollars than you paid for it, but because there's exchanges, you can exchange a Bitcoin for dollars. So if you're trying to avoid the dollar, thinking that the dollar is going to collapse or something and you use Bitcoin, you can't spend Bitcoins. You can only spend the dollars that you get from buying or from selling the Bitcoins, or from buying the Bitcoins, but once you buy the Bitcoin, you can't spend those dollars anymore. Bitcoin is a dead issue. Blockchain has some value. It's a very good accounting technique, but as far as creating a currency from it, it's not going to happen. Currencies must be backed by some entity that's capable of creating value. The United States government presides over the most dynamic, largest, most vibrant economy in the world. And it has the taxing ability. Congress and the president can turn around and raise taxes at any point and gather more money to back the dollar. It's got the Federal Reserve acting as quality control to try to stabilize the value of the dollar. You can make arguments against it all day long, but the dollar, first off, the dollar is a cryptocurrency. Yes, there are actual papers and there's coins that constitute currency, but they are a very, 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 very tiny portion of the number of dollars that are traded digitally each day, that go from place to place, that go from one currency to another currency, or that are exchanged for goods and services across the economy. And those transmissions are encrypted. They're electronic encrypted valuations, and those electronic encrypted valuations constitute a cryptocurrency. The United States dollar is, in effect, a cryptocurrency, and it's the most successful one in the world. And it will remain one as long as we keep our current system. And people have suggested that we don't, that there's a lot of things like treasury securities, which are backed by dollars, may not need to be paid back. Well, they are, because the Constitution of the United States very specifically demands that the United States government will pay on its debts. They will pay their debts when it's due, period, end of argument, end of statement. There's nothing in the Constitution that says the employees of the United States have to be paid. There's nothing in the Constitution that says we have to have a defense budget. There's nothing in there that says any of that. What there is something in the Constitution that says that Treasury securities must, the obligations associated with Treasury securities from the United States must be met, and the taxing authority, the full taxing authority of the federal government stands behind Treasury securities. And when you say, when we say Treasury securities, the dollar bill, if you look on it, says it's a Federal Reserve note. It's signed by the Secretary of the Treasury. It's a note. It is, in effect, a Treasury security. It's a stable value Treasury security. Doesn't pay interest. Matter of fact, it has a negative interest rate of about 2% a year. But it is an obligation of the United States government. There's a promise right over there. There's a signed by the Secretary of the Treasury. There's a promise that they will pay $1 for every dollar that you hold in your hand, $1 worth of goods and services. It's legal tender for all debts, made all transactions private or public. And so the dollar itself is A, a cryptocurrency, and B, backed by the full faith and credit of the United States of America, which has some phenomenal taxing ability. The crypto coins, the bitcoins, are backed by nothing. And no matter how much people would love to see something work outside of a sovereign currency, it is very unlikely to happen. And I say the same thing applies to gold. Among other things, if you look at the dollar, there are dollars in circulation in the world, and we are what's called the reserve currency of the world. The Chinese government and the Russian government hold their reserves primarily in dollars to back their own currency, as do most of the other countries in the world, if not all of them. And the end result is that there isn't enough gold in the world, even at the relatively high price that gold trades at today compared with what it did historically. I say high price after inflation. It's not as high as it was. It's actually down from where it was in the 1980s, and it's certainly down from where it was a few years ago. But there's simply not enough gold in the world to fill the gap for the value of, in other words, if you took all the gold in the world and you tried to substitute it for dollars, it just wouldn't be enough gold to go around. It would cause total chaos and a collapse of the socioeconomic system in the world. It's just something that wouldn't work. You are listening to the Personal Wealth Coach. My name is Jeff McClure. We have about 10 minutes left in the show, and you're certainly welcome to give us a call at 254-773-1400. Last but not least, since we're not getting a whole great host of calls in here, I presume that's because people are listening and thinking, I don't want to interrupt him. It could be that nobody's listening, but who cares? Well, I'm here and I'm talking to the phone ball, and Aaron's listening and smiling, so we're good. There are some longer-term economic cycles that I want to touch on. Now, there's no guarantee these economic cycles will continue forever, but they have continued for as far back as we have economic history, and they are eerily consistent. For example, there is a strong tendency for us to have a recession in the United States on 0 years. It is, for instance, in 2000, we started the plunge into what was the recession of 2000 through 2002. And in 2010, we were still lingering around the bottom of the one that was in 2009. And by the way, we have a telephone call. on 773-1400. And caller, you're on the air with the Personal Wealth Coach. Go ahead.
Yeah, Jeff, this is John calling from Belton. So I was just curious what your thoughts are on the light rail that runs up the I-35 corridor, and is it a good idea? A while back, I was reading something where a mile of road will get you a mile, but a mile-long runway will take you any place. Do you think it would be wiser to put our money in aviation than it would be in light rail?
Oh, okay.
And I'll hang up and listen to your for your question.
Well,
answer right there.
That's a that's an interesting question. The problem with the runway is it doesn't take you anywhere close. You have to have another runway at the other end, and it tends to be relatively noisy, and there's the NIMBY effect of not in my backyard. There's also weather factors. You know, science fiction writers were predicting at this point we'd have flying cars. We obviously don't. Do we have the technology to create enough small aircraft that everybody could be flying their own ultralights or whatever? Yes, they do, except they would be crashing a lot. We don't have an air traffic control system capable of handling it and don't have the technology to do that. And there's the factor of weather. As a former helicopter pilot, I can tell you that there are times you just can't fly. The weather, I mean, if you can, even in the sophisticated aircraft and the sophisticated large runways and airports that we have that can where the aircraft can take off in 0-0 conditions, it's still during periods of time that you have bad weather, it slows the aircraft down tremendously. And if you get thunderstorms near, you can't fly at all. So you can there's a place for aviation, and it is long-distance transportation, no question about it. And we do an amazingly good job there. The light rail is an alternative to the highway. And the issue on the highway is, of course, anybody trying to get in and out of Austin at this point, during rush hour, you just don't want to do it because there's a tremendous amount of time that's going to get wasted. You're going to drive. There's a whole new reason for driving I-35 because that's going to be your average speed, about 35 miles an hour, and it's slowing down with each passing year. The light rail is a good potential way of getting more people into Austin quickly, but, and here's the heavy but, people don't work at the train stations. People have to have a way of getting from the train station to where they work and at the train station at the other end to where they live. In many cases, there are big parking lots near the light rail area where people can pull in and park. But the problem is if you look around Austin, you see that there's no easy way to get from where the light rail drops you off, in many cases, to the place where you work or the place where you want to shop. That is a problem. The solution to that, obviously, New York and London and other and Washington, D.C. have come up with, you really don't need. Matter of fact, in New York City and in Washington, D.C. and some of the other places, you really don't want to have a car because there's no place to park it when you get where you want to go. So they have subways, which is a form of light rail, and it works very, very well. However, as you go west, it works less and less well because the cities to the west, like Austin, and like this area around here, were not laid out with the thought, well, they were not laid out when the horse and buggy was around. Therefore, things are further apart. Therefore, you need a car. Now, the solution, I think, is coming in the self-driving cars of and is already to some degree there with Uber and Lyft, where you can. It's called ride hailing. And it has the ability to get you from light rail to where you want to be. And I think light rail has a tremendous potential. It doesn't always work because of the decentralization and the fact that people like to have their own car. It all depends on once a city gets sufficiently congested, though, some form of mass transportation is just really the only effective way to get around. And having been in New York City, I can tell you that mass transportation, Lyft or Uber or something, is just the only way to get from one place to another effectively. And Austin is getting there. I don't know that they're there yet. As far as putting in a light rail system, if I had in the immediate future, by the time we got a light rail system that ran from Austin to Temple, for example, by the time it's in place, I suspect driving into Austin would be such a pain that people basically wouldn't do it. Therefore, if Austin is going to continue to function as an urban hub and you want to go to things in Austin, at some point you'd want to go on light rail and then have some ride-hailing device or car or system that would take you the final couple of miles to where you want it to go. The problem with those with that is if you wait until it's a crisis to build it, you can't build it. It's too expensive. It won't work. It takes years to build these things. So in my opinion, building a high-quality light rail system to get people from the Austin metropolitan area into the area where the businesses and entertainment is concentrated makes sense, but it takes some planning, and there's a whole area there of interest. I was talking about long-term cycles a moment ago, but let me tell you about another one. You may have heard of the post-World War II economic boom that occurred in the United States instead of a depression. There's a lot of economists, and there's a lot of fear that we had a depression following World War I. It was partially triggered by the great stimulus that World War One, the spending in World War One, put a great deal of stimulus into the system, very much like the stimulus program we just saw, only much bigger as a percentage of the economy. And the hangover from that is one of the causes of the Great Depression. There was a lot of concern coming out of World War II we were going to have another one. One of the reasons we did not have a depression coming out of World War II is we were in an expansive mood in the United States. And we decided to do a couple of things. We decided to use the Marshall Plan to re-innovate Europe and to get it back on its feet so they wouldn't collapse into another war. And at the same time, the Eisenhower administration pushed through a bill called the Defense Interstate Highway Act. And the Defense Interstate Highway Act, he tried to push through the act to build interstate highways across the United States like the Autobahns in Europe. Because he saw how efficient it was to get around Germany compared with getting around the United States. And the Supreme Court overruled it, said that the federal government did not have the authority to build interstate highways. The states were supposed to build the highways because the Constitution did not give that authority to the federal government. However, the federal government did have the right to control and fund the defense. The interstate highway system was originally set up to move, at least theoretically, to move troops and equipment around the United States to defend the United States against foreign invaders. And everybody bought off on that. It was constitutionally sound. So the Defense Interstate Highway Act was passed, I think it was 1950-something, 54. And I may be wrong on that date. And the great infrastructure expansion that resulted from the Defense Interstate Highway Act allowed the tremendous growth in the capacity to provide goods, manufactured goods, to people in the United States, far, far greater than anything we'd had before, far greater than the railroads, far greater than the regular highway system that we had. And it completely transformed the country. And you can see that towns away from the interstate highway system kind of shriveled up, and the ones on the highway system did well. It was the second great expansion in the United States. The first one came when the railroads were put in. Again, the government stepped in and offered the railroads land, a big swath of land along the boundaries of the railroads running across the country if they would build a railroad. Why did they do that? It was to encourage them to build the railroad, and then they could sell or give away the land nearby, and the farmers would grow things and put them on the railroad, and the railroads could be profitable. But the issue is, building infrastructure is the way to have good long-term growth. If you don't build infrastructure, you can't have long-term growth. If you just simply try to fund growth without building the infrastructure, you're going to pay the price for it down the road, and it's not going to be too pretty. And unfortunately, and again, it's an experiment that's going on. I just stated one side of an argument. The other side of the argument is, and the president has made it, Ludlow has made it, that if you stimulate the economy enough, it'll grow, and then people will figure out how to build infrastructure. But in fact, in history, what we've seen is the government has to get involved well in advance of the need and build the infrastructure. And once the infrastructure is built, the government just has to get out of the way while the economy grows to fill the infrastructure. It's kind of using Parkinson's law to your advantage. We're about out of time here on the Personal Wealth Coach. We got about 1 minute left in the show, so it's time to tell who we are. The Personal Wealth Coach is a wealth management firm, an SEC-registered investment advisor, not approved or disapproved by the SEC, but they're the ones who inspect us and regulate us, so you file a complaint, you can file it with them. And we generally serve families with $1 million or more in investable net worth. and we give investment advice and help manage their affairs. And you're certainly welcome to give us a call off the air at 254-947-1111 or 1-800-914-7526. It's 1-800-914-PLAN. Or you can contact me, Jeff at TPWC or Jeff at thepersonalwealthcoach.com. There are podcasts at the website, thepersonalwealthcoach.com. So until next week, this has been The Personal Wealth Coach.